the very tight, the very sexy,
Dr. Kenji Inaba.
All right, Kenji, so we're going to talk about something that's really important. I wish we didn't have to talk about it, frankly, because they're usually pretty horrific cases when you first see them. But near-hanging injuries and strangulation. And I thought that we would use the corpendium format to lead us through this. So we're going to pretend we're first in the resus bay with a really bad patient, and then we're going to sort of move through some of the basic elements of diagnosis and treatment. Does that sound good?
Sounds perfect.
I guess I didn't really give you a choice, did I? Just sort of say this is what we're doing.
Near-hanging injuries, part one.
It's a very important topic. Unfortunately, we all see it, and there's definitely an impact, I think, on us as a team, because, you know, in the vast majority of these cases here in the US, there's an element of suicidality associated with it. So it really, it's a sobering thing. It's tough for the team. And I think on a personal level, these patients are often young, and I think that it's striking for all of us. And these are tough cases to deal with. So, you know, doing our best to make sure that we do everything properly is so important.
You know, it's interesting because so many of our trauma specialty topics or subtopics are just like that, where it's like burns was another example. And it's all about trying to focus on the basics and the ABCs because the actual thing, the bad thing, the burn, the hanging is so distracting that it takes all we can muster to focus, like you said, on getting it right, because we just have to go back to basics. And if we do, we end up coming out okay on these, even though they're scary. Okay, so let me set the stage with the case. A 15-year-old boy is found in his bedroom, hanging from a rope attached to a light fixture. His breathing is labored, and he is responsive only to pain. He is periodically extremely agitated and combative. And so this really sets it up, because it is more often the case than not that when the patients are altered, and again, I wish we didn't have experience with this, is that it's kind of scary in terms of the agitation. You're like, is this hypoxia? Is this from brain injury? But it's very common for them to be agitated. And the reason that's so scary is because you know the whole time, this is compromising airway, this is compromising breathing, and I have to stop it, right?
Absolutely. And I think, like you mentioned, there's all those different things that could come into it. There's the intoxicants, drugs, other substances that we have to think about. And so as a general rule, right from the outset, I like to think of these patients, and I'm sure you do as well, as those that come in with a normal GCS. They're 15 and they're conversing, and you get the history more from the EMS providers or from the patient versus what you're describing. And I think those are very distinct patient populations that we're dealing with, and it's probably easiest to think of them in terms of those two categories.
Yeah, so in your mind, and I think this is really important to highlight, the approach to the critical patient in your mind, in Kenji's mind, is really the approach to anyone who doesn't look normal. And that's a really important point. It's easy to get discouraged when you see someone who's on the lower end of the GCS spectrum and you're like, ah, this isn't going to work out well. What a tragedy. But we have to keep in mind that that's an illusion, that the prognosis in these cases is surprisingly good. And we have to remember that whether it's looks like bad brain injury, whether it looks like bad lung injury, because they can get that, we'll get into that in a second, they can recover, and they do.
I agree. So I think if the patient has arrested, that is a patient that's not going to do well. But everybody else that's between the GCS of 15 and cardiac arrest, I could not agree with you more. 100% max effort, you know, regardless of age, because it could be that what you're looking at is intoxicants or substances on board that's giving you this initial first impression. And those things are all potentially reversible. The actual incidence of a surgically correctable or need to be surgically corrected lesion is actually very low. And so for that reason, I think it's 100% worthwhile pushing forward. So I agree with you.
So I'm going to take us actually right through these ABCs. And of course, as you know, that doesn't begin with A really, it begins with C. And cervical spine has to be protected here. And it is true that the incidence of a C-spine fracture is higher with a sort of a judicial hanging, a completed hanging where there's a drop. It's a lot less likely in this patient's bedroom, right? Just, you know, just because of the mechanics of it. But it still happens. And the recommendation really is still really rigorous C-spine precautions for all these cases. Is that not correct?
You can look at these large series that look at the near hangings, or you can look at series looking at the completed hangings. The reality is, in both of these groups, because of the mechanism that you're talking about, these are not high-level falls at the end of a noose. They are usually done in a home, sometimes in public or at a workplace, but they're very slow and there isn't that abrupt jerking motion on the spine. So as a direct result of that, the likelihood of a severe permanent cervical spine fracture is actually really low. And it is exceedingly rare that we will see that hangman's fracture. It just doesn't occur. And the incidence is low, but it's not zero. And because of that, it's definitely worthwhile protecting that spine.
And just to clarify the terminology here, in case anyone was confused, when Kenji says that those hangings were completed, he means that they were unfortunately successful, they were fatal. That's not to be confused with the commonly used terms complete and incomplete hanging. A complete hanging is when the body is suspended and neither foot touches the ground, and an incomplete hanging is where some part of the body is touching. But the point is mostly academic. Most of the hangings that we are going to see from a home or an office environment are going to be of the low velocity type and are less likely to result in dramatic fracture patterns. All right, I want to talk about indications for intubation, Kenji, and I do want your input on this. I've sort of boiled it down into three categories. If there's any sign of airway obstruction, obviously stridor, you know, I'm not going to tolerate that. That patient's going to be intubated right away. But that also includes looking a little bit around the corner. I mean, if there's signs of impending compromise, you've got multiple fractures, what happens with those? You know they get edematous. If there's sub-Q emphysema, what happens with that? We know it expands. So if there's any impending signs of obstruction, for sure, those are one category. Then I have my second category, which is if there's any signs of pulmonary insult. If I'm hearing crackles on both sides, if the respiratory rate is up at 30, that's not getting better. They're suffering some insult that's probably going to get worse, not better. And so that's another big category for me. It also includes hypoxemia, same reason. And then the third one, this might be a little more controversial. I'd like to hear your take on it. But I would say significant alteration in mental status. You know, you see in the books and you see in the references, you know, Glasgow of 8. I don't think that's good enough. I don't want to wait around in someone who, again, like this patient, is intermittently agitated, maybe getting their blood pressure right up, maybe really endangering the situation. I wouldn't put a hard and fast number. I think there's a lot of patients that have Glasgow's much higher than 8 that really should be intubated for safety here. So those are my sort of categories. What's your take on all that?
There are two points that I would make. I agree first with the not preemptive, but being very conservative when it comes to people that have these potentially, you know, the airway's not obstructed right now, but, you know, over the next 10, 15, 20, 30 minutes, it can get worse. If you look at the injuries, the actual mechanical injuries that are by this mechanism, the reality is, again, although they are relatively infrequent, when they do occur, one of the major things that gets injured is the whole laryngeal-tracheal complex. And the reality is we know that whenever you're going to constrict the neck, that's one of the first things to get injured, fractured, or even just crushed. And so that patient that comes in that has what appears to be a viable airway, but a tenuous viable airway, I think it's just safer to get that out of the picture. So I agree 100%. When you look at these airways, they really are fragile, and having a constricting object around the neck really can do a tremendous amount of damage to that airway. And it's just right there. It's not protected by anything at all. So if you're worried that there's been damage that's done to that airway, it will get worse over the intervening next minutes to hours, and it's worth protecting that patient. Now, as far as the GCS, yes. There's no good data that is going to support when it is that we should be intubating these patients. And, you know, to some certain extent, we're going to be relying on our judgment. And so I would agree with you. I think we ought to be cautious with them. These are patients that truly can survive. So we want to do everything that we can to optimize them. And oxygenation is a key component of that. The most important thing is the edema. Because they, you know, of the, whatever, 5 to 10% of people that have an anatomic injury, half of them are going to be the airway. And, you know, the other question that often comes up is, if we're forced to do a surgical airway, either because we couldn't intubate, the view wasn't sufficient, or things cascade too quickly and you're forced to do that surgical airway, the reality is there are no changes that we're going to make to our traditional approach to getting that surgical airway. But I think everybody needs to be well aware that, again, one of the reasons why you're in that situation is probably because of the soft tissue swelling and edema and the damage. So it's well worth ensuring that all the things that we normally do to make sure that we get into the airway, we're extra cautious about that. So the length of the incision, for example, getting an assistant, as much light as possible. And if you can't see, you may need to lengthen that incision more, especially if there's a lot of bleeding and soft tissue edema in that area. You've got to be aggressive to make sure that you really take a look to see exactly where it is that you're cutting down. And once you get down to the airway itself, anatomically, I would go for the same spot because of all the edema. And if there's a fracture to that area, it may be more difficult. But again, going to your basics and identifying the landmarks that we're looking for, your cricoid, your thyroid cartilage, and looking for the space.
And what's
that,
in between them.
And what's in between.
Thank you.
That's the key. So I think that that's really important. Now, if that whole structure has been fractured and you simply, it's one big mushy mess, and the structures that we're looking for, the cricoid, the thyroid cartilage, those may actually be fractured. If you can't get the traditional hole into that traditional membrane and you need to go into the trachea below the normal entry point, I think that's perfectly fine. Because if you really think about it, that is where we do all of our surgical airways in the traditional non-emergent situation. So the key is to get a tube into the airway regardless of where it goes in.
Okay, perfect. And I added that, you know, for the children that are less than 8 for sure,
yes,
and unfortunately they are an important part of this demographic, we can go with a jet ventilation if we need to as an option as well.
Whether it's in the child or in the adult population, it is a very effective way of getting oxygen down the tube.
Breathing.
Moving on to breathing, we've already kind of covered that. Breathing is really important because it informs whether or not you intubate the patient. I alluded to that. And of course, we're looking for signs of pulmonary edema, ARDS. And I suppose that if you are intubating these patients, it would behoove you to follow the low volume ventilation strategies of the ARDS-NET protocol. But other than that, I don't have any other particular things that you have to keep in mind. Do you have anything else for breathing?
Yeah, you know, I would just say that it's interesting that when you do a literature survey like we did before this, and I know we both did independent looks, there's a lot that has been written about this pulmonary edema that's associated with this mechanism of injury. And it's interesting because we do see it in the most critically ill patients that come in, usually those that are near arrest or that are very sick. But the reality is it's not very common. It also takes time for it to develop. So it's probably not, in most cases, something that's going to be seen in the emergency department setting. However, you know, it is something that can happen afterwards by the time the patient has gone to CT, they're in the ICU now. That's where we do see it, if we're going to see it. So to guard against that, I think that, yes, there are some considerations with fluids and things like that. But the reality is, in the emergency department itself, it is a relatively unlikely thing that you're going to be seeing.
Circulation.
And as you're saying, Kenji, whether they develop the pulmonary edema because of the pulmonary pathophysiology here, or secondary to the cerebral edema, which is another reason why people get pulmonary edema, there's actually a bunch of reasons why they can get it. The upshot of that is that we do need to be judicious with fluids. And so we obviously are going to resuscitate people that are hypotensive, but we're not going to overdo it. And in fact, one of the critical take-home messages here is that if someone like the patient in our scenario comes to you hypotensive, your first question should be, what else am I missing here? Is there, you know, is there a toxicologic reason, an ingestion? Is there some other trauma? Maybe I'm dealing with a splenic injury. So it's really, really important to get back to basics and search for a cause for shock, not just to paper it over.
The reality is, it is exceedingly rare for there to be a vascular injury in the cervical segment of the body that's bleeding. If there's going to be an arterial injury, it's going to be a dissection or a flap or some sort of injury like that that's usually contained and not bleeding. But like you said, there may be other toxins that were ingested, or you know, if it was somebody that hung themselves on a chair and as they were being lowered, they dropped and hit the ground, there could be a spleen injury or a liver injury concurrently. It's super rare, but those things have to be considered. So I think it's important to ensure that if a patient is looking a little hypotensive, that we really ask the question, what is that from? And in the treatment, you're right. If we flood them with fluids as a knee-jerk response, that could cause problems as they hit the ICU later with pulmonary edema. So those are all really good points.
Okay, and just one last thing under circulation that I think is important is that we're always questioning whether things that we do are really relevant, right? We don't go crazy with C-spine precautions in patients with gunshot wounds to the neck anymore, right? We got to be smart about what we do in terms of these knee-jerk responses. So here, just for the record, I want to say that continuous cardiac monitoring in these patients actually is important because they have been known to have these sort of irregular sympathetic bursts of activity where their vitals can go wonky and they can have dysrhythmias that are quite life-threatening. And so this is not a case to, oh, this was, you know, this is a trauma and, you know, the vitals were normal. I don't have to worry about this. No, this is a case where they really need to be on the monitor. So I wanted to make that extra point.
Agreed.
Disability.
Now, getting down to disability, from the minute they hit the door, I mean, you made the point. This is not a surgical intervention that's going to make their prognosis better. It's going to be the medical management for the most part, right? And so much of that hinges on the head of the bed. And so when we know that there's expanding injury in the brain, it's a big deal. We want to make sure that the head of the bed, all other factors being equal, is elevated at 30 degrees. And so that's the big thing really early on that you're doing about disability. I mean, obviously, if they're herniating, you're going to be taking other steps. But do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, we really need to be cognizant that these patients could have an oxy-induced brain injury, and everything that we can do until we get that imaging done so that we can look at the brain to see what it's doing is critical. So all the steps that we can take, including the head of bed at 30, I think is definitely worthwhile.
And so much of the pathophysiology here, so much of the mechanism of injury here is about those occluded venous channels. And as the back pressure is building, so much of the damage to the brain is from that. And likewise, in the hospital, we can add to that damage if we don't promote that drainage of the jugular venous system.
Exactly. These are very soft veins that are in your neck, and the ligatures are going right around them. Whereas the arteries may be able to tolerate them, the veins may be collapsed. So I think that that's a great point.
Exposure.
Okay, Kenji. So the last letter in the alphabet that they accuse us of knowing, E, is for exposure. And it's really important to do that complete skeletal survey, etc., in this patient, is it not?
Yeah, I think it's really, like you said, it is really important at the moment that they've decided that they're going to do this and they let go. You know, there's a lot of things that'll occur, but one of them is going to be a reaction, and they're going to jerk and they're going to flail, and there may be chairs there. They may be close to a wall or a door frame, and there's definitely the possibility that a skeletal injury, or when they're dropped, they can break bones as well. So it really is important that although the main focus of our clinical exam is going to be the neck and the head area, we really do need to make sure that we don't miss a skeletal fracture that has gone along with it.
This is the end of the first section, the ABDCE section, and now we move on to the rapid access section.